Hello, this is the Game Podcast from The Times, and I'm Natalie Sawyer. Delighted to say that Gregor Robertson is back with us today, as is Alison Rudd. So welcome to both of you. Alison, how are you doing? How are you coping at the moment?
Well, I'm obviously very busy going angling, and I've caught a couple of carp.
Oh, sure.
And it's the centre of my life now.
No pond swimming yet for you? I hear that's something we can do.
Bizarre, isn't it? They have not thought this through.
No, a little bit odd it is. Gregor, you're back. You've had a week off. Obviously, you've been here, there and everywhere. Obviously not.
Trip to the Bahamas, back home to Scotland. No, basically back garden, son and myself, and yes. Having a little break. Nice.
Nice. Nice to have a little rest as such. And Alison, how about your competitive household? How's that faring?
We're probably getting more, not less, competitive, which is, which means in about 6 weeks' time we will implode, won't we? And no, but it's fine. It's fine. To be quite honest, I'm not sure how households who are not competitive are coping, because if you are competitive, it brings an element of adrenaline and excitement to the most mundane tasks. So I've, as you know, invented football Scrabble, but we're inventing a new Scrabble almost per day. And that leads to lots of existential arguments on what is and isn't allowed. And people care because they're competitive. So you can't have an argument over phonetic Scrabble and whether a word counts or not unless you care about the outcome. So you get to some quite deep, deep, meaningful conversations, and I think that's what's kept my household ticking over okay in lockdown.
I bet. So the latest Scrabble is phonetic Scrabble, that's what you're at?
Yes, but of course, if you have to spell everything phonetically, what happens if you have a great word that's just a normal word? Do you have to ban all normal words? And then it starts getting tricky.
Oh my goodness. I can see why it's very competitive then where you are, Alison. Just before we move on, Gregor, is your household just as competitive? What about, I don't know, a margarita off?
No, I'm the winner hands down at those. But yes, actually, more in the fitness stakes. Susie, my fiance, she's been furloughed and she's just taken the time to be. She'll be delighted.
Has she done more press-ups than you?
Honestly, I don't want to tell you how close we were in the press-up stakes.
Wow.
She would be delighted that you're allowed to exercise as many times as you want outside a day now.
Go for it, Susie. I like it. Okay, coming up, we'll get the latest on Project Restart, and we're looking back on the bizarre reign of Louis van Gaal at Manchester United. All that to come after this.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Now, as the days become weeks and the weeks become months in lockdown, it's important to remember how crucial mental health is during this coronavirus pandemic. It's something Jonathan Northcroft has written about in the Sunday Times this weekend with the help of Liverpool's performance psychologist Lee Richardson. Now, before we get into the full details of what Jonathan wrote about, Lee Richardson is perhaps a familiar name to some, and Gregor, you've come across him before, haven't you?
Yes, he signed me for Chesterfield back in 2007, I think it was. He had quite a short-lived managerial career. I think it was really a couple of seasons, just over a couple of seasons. And we always just fell short of the playoffs. He put together a good team and he got Alan Nil, who's now the Sheffield United assistant coach, as his assistant for a while, and Scott Sellers. And they were good coaches. He wasn't a coach. He was the kind of a manager, and he was someone who was a thinker. He was a little bit different. You could I say different, and different in the realms of what a football manager is. And he kind of, he definitely had that analytical side to him, and there were a lot of kind of team meetings and trying to motivate the players. That was his role. So I'm not surprised that this is the route he's gone down.
Okay, well, he was a former pro with the likes of Watford, Blackburn, Aberdeen and Oldham. Lee and his older brother Nick, who also played professionally, have created a mental health support hub called the Safety Net. It's currently used by the PFA, but he's now thrown it open to be accessed free of charge for those struggling during this pandemic. To access it, you simply head to aim-4.com/safetynet, and after registering there's information and guidance on a range of issues including stress, bereavement and dependency. Well, Lee Richardson also explains how football needs to do more to tackle mental health. He says there's a paradox about mental health, which is, yes, we should want people to come forward and access help, but it is also important to provide people the choice and the opportunity to self-help and to self-manage. We need to reduce the stigma of mental health, and there are several sorts of stigma, the most pervasive one being self-imposed stigma. The person who thinks, am I anxious? Am I depressed? What will happen if I come forward? I don't want to accept I'm in that position. So do we think, Alison, that sport and perhaps football in particular are behind society when it comes to tackling mental health?
No, I think they were terribly. When I saw we were going to discuss this, I immediately got a flashback to 2001. And I will confess, the reason I knew the year straight away was it was the first time I saw Yari Littmanen play live, and I was at Aston Villa, and the story at Aston Villa was supposed to be about Juan Pablo Angel, who had come in from River Plate and a lot of money, record signing, and he was a bit of a flop initially and the fans didn't like him. And it transpired slowly that he'd struggled to adapt. He'd been left to his own devices by the club. Eventually, it turned out that there was a significant illness with his wife and child, I think. But before people knew that, they just knew, all they knew about him was he was struggling to adapt to a new culture. And John Gregory was the manager, and he was sort of fairly dismissive of the idea that maybe a player from another continent might just need to be given a helping hand, an arm around the shoulder, a chance to find someone in the local community who had the same background and so on. And it was a case of, they paid a lot of money. We might help them find a house. What more do they want, sort of thing? And that, I think, was indicative of the whole approach to footballers, which is the idea that if you're paid enough money, you don't need any other help. And of course, I think one of the big myths that has been exploded in mental health is that it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor, or anything that materially about your life is irrelevant. You can still suffer. And in fact, it's probably exacerbated if people make assumptions that if you can afford a nice house, therefore you must be extremely happy and content. And that makes it more difficult to work out what's going wrong with you mentally. But I think with increasing numbers of people involved in the sport being able to say, look, I've struggled and this is how I struggled, and also explaining to fans, you can even play quite well when you've got mental issues. You just throw yourself into your sport. You might self-harm or do other things privately to get through it. So just even if you're playing well, it doesn't mean that everything's going fine in your life. So I think sport and football have caught up, but I still think that there's the problems about, that assumption, if you're paid a lot of money, you must be all right. And that's probably still lingers, I think. If you're famous and rich, what right have you got to have a mental problem?
Well, Gregor, we'll get on to how you may have noted a change in attitude at the start of your career to the end of it. But it was interesting what Alison was talking there about Juan Pablo Angel and the struggles he may have had to adapt to playing and living in another country. With some of the players that you played with, and I'm assuming you will have played with some players who don't come from England or Scotland, let's say. Did you ever see any of them struggle with adapting?
Yeah, I mean, there's numerous reasons that players can, you know, that players can have for having difficulties in this area, and that's certainly one of them. Yeah, I've played with players who've come from overseas and struggle to fit in, but it can be a personal issue or anything that goes on in life. I think the difference, you know, in the time I played football in the early days, any discussion of what goes on in your mind was only focused on motivation. I even remember in the youth team at Nottingham Forest, we had loads of kind of motivational speakers come in, and it was always focused on improving performance in the game. Whereas now, there's a kind of widespread acknowledgement and understanding that the rigors and stresses of playing football, or playing professional sport, and as well as things that go on in life in general, can have kind of adverse negative effects on performance and on an individual. So I think that is the journey that's happened in the kind of couple of decades I played. And that's roughly the same time frame. I just think that there's more. I think that kind of follows society. I don't think, you know, I think football has come on leaps and bounds in that regard, but there's still a way to go. I mean, I still speak to some people. I spoke to someone the other day who's a kind of a coach in an academy, a Premier League academy, and he was talking about a couple of players who are young players as well, who are having real difficulties just now in terms of fears about being out of contract. There was one player who's scared to go outside and go for a run because of the virus. And you know, kind of, there's still a tendency to have kind of throwaway comments about these people being soft. That still exists. There's no doubt that still exists in football. So we've come a long way, but there's still it's a macho industry, and there is a kind of, it is a world where the coaching can be brutal. It can be a ruthless kind of industry, and sometimes it has to be to get the most out of people. So it's a unique industry in that regard. And it's certainly, football has improved greatly, though.
I mean, it's interesting. I don't know if I should flag this up, but I will. The comments section after Jonathan's article on the Times website, there aren't the nicest responses. Some of them say, well, where does mental health stop and spoilt brat begin? Another one says, another overplayed mental health article, with someone else jumping on the bandwagon. It's comments like that, Alison, that certainly don't help to have this conversation about the importance of understanding mental health.
No, I think that those sorts of attitudes will even be prevalent within the hierarchy of the football club as well. I did a big investigation on football club chaplains who go, well, they're often attached to a club, or they're certainly, you know, encompass the club in their community. And they find they're really, really busy, because footballers will come to them with their problems, which includes mental health issues. And they simply do not want, knowing full well, if you're talking to a chaplain, he has to keep it private, and he can't run to the coach and say, your striker, he might be a bit wobbly on Saturday, don't pick him. I think if you're in that sort of industry, if you admit to struggling, the repercussions can be sudden and enormous if it's not handled properly. And people, as Gregor said, it's mainly people, when they think about psychology, they're thinking about motivation and results. They're not thinking about things that go much deeper. So you don't want your career to be stalled or your reputation to be damaged by admitting to having difficulties. And so it's a good thing that clubs do have chaplains attached to them that can offer this. But they know the chaplains themselves aren't the best counsellors in the world. They've just seen a lot and know a lot and are patient and will listen. But I think it's awfully interesting that the busiest sort of vicars, if you like, in the world are the ones who pop into a football club. Because there is, as coming back to your point, Natalie, people find it very hard to be sympathetic to someone who appears to have it all. You know, the dream job. We all, everyone who's kicked a ball dreams about being the one that would have been picked for a professional club. The money's mostly good. You have so many fans, you have so many followers on Twitter, you know, you go into a nightclub and have 20 women at your feet. I mean, it looks perfect, doesn't it? And that's the problem, I think, which is why I really like this initiative from Lee Richardson, which talks about, let's not make it all about having to come forward. And I think that can be counterproductive. I think if you're struggling and then you hear or read an article where someone famous is praised for admitting to having some mental health problems, you might then think, oh my goodness, am I only going to feel better if I have to announce to the world that I'm struggling with depression or whatever it is that's your problem? And it doesn't have to be that way. For lots of people, the very best way to recover would be to do it on your own, to be given the tools to work through either on your own or with your family, or just very privately to get through something. And I do think, in a way, I think we might have moved too far to that sort of stand up, raise your hand and be lauded for being brave, for telling people there's something wrong with you, because that can put pressure on people who do not want to do that at all. That would not help them and be counterproductive. And that's, you know, it goes with the fame of being a footballer, that everything you do, whether you do something wrong in lockdown or admit to having depression, has repercussions that it wouldn't have for just, you know, an accountant in an office somewhere in Swindon.
Well, I know that there has been a spike in the number of footballers in England seeking mental health support since the start of this lockdown. In the first quarter of this year, the PFA said that 299 players had access support, compared to 653 in the whole of 2019. And a lot of that comes down to the fears of financial worries, especially when you're looking in the lower leagues, for example. And Gregor, let me ask you about how you think attitudes have changed in football from the start to the end of your playing career.
Yeah, I mean, I think what was interesting about the piece that Johnny did with Lee Richardson was that Lee Richardson said that really he has an office and his door's open. So it's almost all one-to-one. And that kind of ties with what Alison was saying there, in that it's still a thing that's kind of, it's something that players would want behind a closed door. If you do I've sat through so many kind of presentations and talks from sports psychologists and you know, it's full of kind of jargon often. That's one thing as well Lee Richardson said, is that, you know, he's kind of come from a football background, he can relate, I think, a little bit better with some players. But if it was in a team environment, then people sometimes might crack a joke or, you know, not quite take it seriously. So he has it that someone wants to see him, they can come and see him in the privacy of his office, and that's where you'll get the best results. And I think that's the most important thing. I still think that as far as we have come, it's still something that players don't want to show a weakness. So it's not a perceived weakness. So that's still not changed, and it's not surprised me to hear that, you know, the players who he's dealt with has been on a one-to-one basis like that. I just on the point about the PFA and stuff, this is going to be a huge issue because we've got every year there's players out of contract. I've been out of contract many times. It's a stressful time. And at this moment in time, the numbers are going to be enormous compared to usual. If a player's out of contract, the chances are they're going to be released because the clubs, this is particularly as in the lower leagues, clubs need to get whatever expenditure they have off the books. And so not only are there going to be huge numbers of out-of-contract players, really, there's no guarantee there's going to be an industry, a functioning industry, and clubs ready to employ them again. So it's going to be a tough time. You have to, again, caveat a lot of what we say here with there are other swathes of the economy and industries that are feeling the same thing. But for guys in the kind of mid to late 20s, say, or guys in their early 30s with a family, to find it, really, they might have a few weeks more earnings, and then after that, absolutely a huge unknown is going to be very, 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 very stressful for them.
I suppose, Gregor, it's more the uncertainty of not knowing when football is going to come back. So if a player is out of contract, they're not able to sign for another club because other clubs won't be necessarily making those signings.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, if as it looks likely, Leagues 1 and League 2 are going to be kind of called at this point, and they're talking about perhaps doing a mini playoff system. But there's no way that football at that level can function without paying customers. Or if it does manage to, we don't know how that's going to happen yet. So in that regard, it's looking pretty bleak for what the landscape of football is going to be like at that level. And even if it does function, the numbers are going to be far smaller in terms of what earnings are going to be. So yeah, hugely uncertain time for players. And it's going to be, I think this is only going to kind of grow, and there's going to be a lot of players need support.
Well, let's do a quick update on where we are with football coming back. And news this weekend that a third Brighton player has tested positive for coronavirus. The unnamed player, who will now self-isolate for 14 days, was tested on Saturday. Two other players, remember, tested positive earlier in the pandemic. Brighton players have been training individually at the training ground, and the club say this will be allowed to continue. Now, June the 12th had been the date penciled in by Premier League chiefs to get this season back up and running, but it didn't get a mention in Prime Minister Boris Johnson's address to the nation, making a possible return no clearer than before. So, Alison, when we've heard what's happened now with Brighton, do we really think that football will be back on the 12th of June?
It does sound rather premature, doesn't it? One would assume that if there is this slight loosening of mixing outside the home, then we might see more players coming through as having positive test results, which would delay it further still. I think if it's about waiting for a time when every club has completely cleared its ranks of the COVID, it will never start, actually, because I think there will always be a connection somewhere that makes sure that somebody somewhere has it. So it's about probably sort of just this dream landscape where you have a sort of purity. It's not going to happen. So what you have to do is work towards making the restart able to cope with the fact you might get clubs that have to take a step back in terms of isolation and how they make sure that everyone who goes out on the training pitch and then a competitive pitch is free of the virus. I don't know if that is possible, but that's, I think, what you should aim for. And this conversation has great parallels with the one we've had about mental health, in that any industry you're in, okay, let's take the nurseries coming back. I mean, flowers and bushes and being able to go and buy something to put in your garden is not essential, but it is deemed very important for the nation's mental health. But the people who work in those nurseries and garden centres, they've probably got the same worries as footballers about whether they should, you know, should they be at work? Well, is it absolutely possible to not get closer than 2 metres to somebody else at work and so on? And yet you've got to sort of have this long list of things that do greater good than the potential damage. So I think at the moment the feeling is the potential good for football coming back outweighs the potential damage. But that leaves players as sort of collateral damage, doesn't it? And there are two main issues, I think, that have not been addressed, that need to be addressed. One is the way it looks like black players will be more vulnerable if there is a case out there. They're more vulnerable in the community, therefore they're more vulnerable when they're on a football pitch. Secondly, athletes overall, they have more vulnerable immune systems. That's been mentioned in the Times, but it's not something that I think the players themselves know enough about to feel confident that they're not at more risk than, say, the person who's helping open a garden centre down the road from them. Let's not say that footballers are special and should get more medical attention than a bus driver or someone working in a garden centre, But there may be factors which actually do make them more vulnerable, and they, rather than them being sort of hastily brushed under the carpet, they need to be researched, explored and talked about before I think that most players will feel comfortable about saying, yeah, OK, we feel the science is there, we can do this for the people who we know we can make happy.
It's interesting you mentioned that the health aspect in the sense of the vulnerability of footballers. I was having a conversation with the former Liverpool, Fulham, Tottenham midfielder Danny Murphy, and I put that question to him about the susceptibility of sports people. And he scoffed at it and said, I've never been ill when I played, so I can't see why it would affect us. And it was a bit strange because you felt like he was ignoring what medicine, what science is saying. It's an interesting point to bring up, I think, Alison.
Well, there's lots of reasons why he's never been ill in his life. Maybe he's just very lucky and he has a particularly strong immune system that can cope with being an athlete. But I think the biology says that if you push your body to those extreme levels that extremely fit athletes do, it does give you an immunity. You know, we used to joke about the number of cyclists who seem to have asthma, but it actually, like, well, they're pretending so they can take drugs. Well, no, they weren't pretending, most of them. You do actually end up getting conditions if you are really punishing your body. So, and yes, if you're a footballer, you're so pampered in compared to the rest of us in terms of your health. You know, most Premier League clubs will know everything about your body. You know, they take samples of all bits of you all the time and you're looked after. And the minute someone sneezes, you know, they're concerned about it, which doesn't happen normally. So footballers will look healthy because they are looked after better. But with COVID, we have no way of looking after you better with that. If it gets you, it gets you, and it's going to get you bad if you've got a vulnerable immune system.
Gregor, this is a subject obviously we've been talking about for a long, long time, about when and if football can return. So 12th of June is the date that is still penciled in. We know that. We've seen in Germany they're still pushing ahead with the Bundesliga, and that's the first and second divisions. And we know that Dynamo Dresden has put its whole team into quarantine after players were tested positive there for it. Where do you stand on it now when you hear all of this stuff that we're hearing?
When people make points, I think one of the biggest problems when you know, various chief executives and directors of clubs are making good arguments at the moment, I think there's other clubs who kind of are drawing lines, acting as if because the team are perhaps relegation threat, and that's their reason for making a point, such as, you know, I think Christian Purslow, the Aston Villa CEO, I think he, you know, he said that Jack Grealish, John McGinn, and maybe Tyrone Mings, say those three players fell to the injury, fell to COVID, sorry, which is going to be treated as an injury, which is so bizarre. You know, there has to be some kind of line, has to be a line in the sand for how many players or, you know, that's going to put a stop to games. And I think the Dresden example was the players were quarantined because that was the ruling of that kind of area of Germany. That was, I don't think that was really, you know, a footballing decision. That's because of the area in Germany they live in. That was the rule. So, and they're still acting as if that's just going to kind of pause, that's going to postpone two games for them. So there are huge, you know, so many valid questions. And I think it's just so unhelpful that, you know, I saw Tyrone Mings tweeting today that, you know, if a player towards the top end of the table makes a point about, you know, questioning the safety of returning, then you said, you know, that's some of people would, the response would be, oh, that's a reasonable point. Whereas if somebody like him in the bottom, who's in the bottom three or facing relegation, makes the same point, a finger's pointed at him to say, you know, you're trying to get out of relegation. Yeah. And there are a lot of, you know, there's a lot of conflicting sort of interests, and I think players should be able to voice these queries and questions and look for some sort of, they'll never be guarantees. That's the problem. We've said this before. There's no guarantee. So as Alison said, it's all about risk and reward. It's about minimising the risks as much as possible and making sure the players are happy with that for a start. And the reward is to make sure that the clubs are kind of financially viable in at least the short term, and can pay their players and pay their staff and there's not a kind of a serious black hole opening up for football that there is further down the league. So, you know, when people say, a lot of people always say, you know, that we can't go back, we can't play until it's safe to do so. That's a really stupid expression now, because it will never be safe, not in the short term anyway. It's never going to be safe. It's about making it as safe as possible and making sure the players are okay with that. And that's the biggest hurdle, I think. Now, I think, as Alison said, there are some serious worries among players, and people have got to kind of assuage their fears, you know?
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
Yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Now, Louis van Gaal has been speaking about his departure from Manchester United in 2016, and it makes for interesting reading. Sacked just 2 days after winning them the FA Cup, their first trophy since Alex Ferguson's departure, and replaced by Jose Mourinho, who had previously been his number two at Barcelona. Van Gaal is in no doubt where the blame lies, but it's nothing to do with Mourinho. In Manchester, he says, there was a noose around my neck for 6 months. I was put down in public, and yet the players had so much confidence in me that we had to finish the FA Cup final with 10 men and still won. My wife had known it for 6 months, but women also have much better feelers for that. But I never expected to be killed by people internally. In any case, a great experience, but if you stay upright as a coach in such a six-month situation, then you must have something to offer. I blame Ed Woodward, my CEO at Manchester United, much more than Mourinho. In my view, Woodward is the evil genius. Now, Alison, of course, we'll agree with what Van Gaal said about his wife and that women have much better feelers than men. That's just a given, obviously. But should Van Gaal feel hard done by what happened at United?
Well, probably, yes. Although I think most Man United fans will be thinking he's being very generous with his assessment of Woodward as a genius, whether he's evil or good with it. I mean, there's a lot of evidence that Ed Woodward is far from a genius in the transfer market. And that was partly the problem, as it is with every manager post-Ferguson at United, is the transfers. And yeah, Mourinho would probably agree with Van Gaal that it was, you know, not being able to buy who you want and balancing all the vested interests and so on. I think Van Gaal is a hard one to explain, because he seemed to go from being himself a footballing genius to someone who just had no emotional intelligence whatsoever and was unable to sort of grasp how the Premier League worked, you know, the style of football, the fan base. If he'd gone into Old Trafford with the remit, can you make Manchester United the most boring team anyone's ever seen? Then he'd say he did a fantastic job. I mean, they had those stats when he was there were ridiculous. They had, you know, they were on the par with Stoke and Norwich on how many shots the team made. They made more passes backwards than anyone else in the league. This was not this is not what a team like Man United is supposed to employ, someone with those principles. And yet he was always a surprise. It wasn't like he was just dour and boring himself. The football was boring, but he was always completely sort of fascinating. And you couldn't predict what sort of odd thing he was going to come up with. So it was a terrible experiment, but I think calling Ed Woodward a genius is the oddest part of all that.
Well, you talk about some of the highlights of Van Gaal. He was certainly entertaining, arguably off the pitch more than on the pitch. He He called his defender Chris Smalling Mike Smalling. He pulled a reporter's hair during a post-match interview. He screamed Louis van Gaal's army in a press conference, called a journalist a fat man after disagreeing with one of his questions, and of course threw himself on the floor at Old Trafford during a game with Arsenal to make a point to the fourth official Mike Dean. I mean, when you list those sorts of things, surely we miss him, don't we, Gregor, for those antics?
He was box office. You know, I think there's some parallels with Mourinho. It's kind of these guys, these two huge figures of football, like, amazing catalogue of work behind them, successes, massive characters, could be real kind of absolute box office, as I say. But in recent years, and certainly that period at Manchester United with Van Gaal and Mourinho in recent times, they just feel like yesterday's men. I just think that, you know, all of that off-field stuff was great fun, and they're great characters, and the Premier League is better off for having people like that in it. But the evidence on the pitch tells you otherwise. I think that, you know, as you said, the football was so boring. and, you know, there was a lot of mitigating factors. You look at, you know, when he took over from Boys, some of the same issues about the structure of the club and the signings. If looking at some of his signings, Luke Shaw, Herrera, Rojo, Di Maria, Memphis Depay, Darmian, Schneiderlin, Schweinsteiger, they're really not many hits from them. And I don't think that's down to him. So, you know, there's huge issues at Manchester United, and that's, you can't lay all of that at Van Gaal's door. But at the same time, the way he coached them and the football that Manchester United played under him was soporific.
Mm. And of course, Alisson, you've got to get on with the fans. And he sort of had this antagonistic relationship with them. He often called them out at various times.
That's what I mean about not really having any emotional intelligence. Did he not read about Man United before? I mean, does he not know where he is and who they are and how it all works? I find that incredible. Does it mean that he has an enormous ego and thinks... That's how he came across, wasn't it? I suspect he was a really nice bloke, but he came across as having a huge ego and felt, I'm in charge. Why on earth would you criticise me? I've come in to save you. And I really can't be doing with all this nonsense that's going around the periphery of it. And yet he was giving them very boring football and then telling the fans, your expectations are too high. You can't be manager of Manchester United and tell the fans your expectations are too high. It doesn't happen. So, and he's clearly not a stupid person. So I am struggling to understand what... I wonder if maybe, because he was coming in as a rescue mission from David Moyes, I wonder if perhaps he felt he had... more rope, you know. He had longer in which to write things, and that any positive tweaks would be greeted as the saviour, rather than people thinking, "Oh, thank goodness, David Moyes' era is over. We've got a proper manager of international stature who'll be more like Fergie." I suspect that was the problem.
Well, he did have this big brash personality. He probably still does as well, I'm sure. And it seemed as though, you mentioned stature, that because of that, he'd be able to embrace the stature of Old Trafford, the stature of Manchester United as well. So he seemed the perfect fit. But Gregor, it just didn't work. Why didn't it work?
I think some of those reasons I gave. I think that, you know, he's mentioned the power that Ed Woodward wields, and the sort of issues in the way that players were recruited. You know, I think it's quite easy for him now to say that, say when he signed Angel Di Maria, that he was someone who was lower down his list of wingers that he wanted to sign. He said recently he wanted to sign him 7 years earlier when he was at AZ Alkmaar, rather than at that point in time. So, you know, you look at those signings, that's not all his fault. So that's the first thing you have to say. But again, the way that the team played, I kind of flipping between formations, so pedestrian and slow, the football. And I think Alisson sort of searching for why he thought, he thought he could, I don't know why he thought he had more time. I think it's just ego with these people. I honestly think that someone like him and Mourinho, their egos are so enormous, and they feel when they walk in the door that they're sort of sheer force of personality. And they have had huge success in the past too. Like I say, I just think that the game moved on and they were slightly left behind. I think that's the same.
Are they
same
sort of living
Mourinho
off their
now.
Name, would you say? Is that what it's all down to?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, look, he's retired now, and I think Mourinho, as I say, I think there's some similarities to be drawn between the two of them. I think that the way that he sets up his team to play now feels like from another era. So part of that is to do with the way that the game evolves, and part of it is to do with, I don't know, I feel like they almost struggle to come to an acceptance of that fact as well. So they almost row against the tide, and they feel, you know, I'm Louis van Gaal, or I'm Jose Mourinho, what do you guys know? And I think that kind of comes out, and that showed in some of the press conferences and some of the decisions he made on the pitch. I mean, I was looking back, I remember one when he took off Rashford at half-time against, I think it might be against Liverpool, no, it was against Spurs, and he put Ashley Young centre-forward. And that was, I think that was when the kind of, almost the straw that broke the camel's back. And, you know, he talked about, just this week, about how the players had supported him and stuff. I don't think that was true either. I think he was delusional there. I think the players really thought, I think they were bored by training, and they looked at some of the decisions he made and thought, and the football they were being asked to play, and thought, what is this guy doing? So I think he's also deluding himself slightly.
Well, we've listed some of the antics of Van Gaal then, and both of you no doubt would have encountered some characterful managers. What's your favourite bizarre moment from a gaffer down the years? Alison, you've got one?
I think it's because we've been talking about Louis van Gaal that I've thought of this. But because I see similarities in the sort of the way they came in, is Felix Magath. Do you remember him? He took over at Fulham. She's just down the road for me. So there's a lot I could say about Felix Magath, but you can't really start a conversation about him without talking about him telling Breda Hangeland to put a big lump of cheese on his injury, and that would solve everything. And he even got someone in the staff to go to the supermarket to go and buy the biggest lump of cheese he could find. And then a few years later, he admitted that is the advice, but then said that the English media were silly with it. I mean, what is the British media supposed to do with a manager who tells the player that they'll come back quicker and stronger and able to walk better if they have cheese all over them? I mean, it's ridiculous, man. But on a serious level, that you wouldn't mention that, would you, if he was a really nice guy and got results and it was just a quirk of his character? But he wasn't a very nice person, really. He was really, really strict and used to make the players do odd things in training, either not move at all or play far too long to punish them. I've no idea why he lasted as long as he did, but I'm sort of glad in a way that the results were bad and that you can't win with that sort of attitude. So that's good.
Yeah, he certainly did sound very bizarre. Gregor, before we get your bizarre moment from a manager, did you ever have to put cheese on an injury?
No. I would have tried it if it had any chance of working, the number of injuries I had. No, certainly not. I think if we're talking about a manager I played for, I mean, it would probably be Joe Kinnear. And look, when we saw all the stuff happened at Newcastle about him sort of naming players by their wrong names, you know, I think he called Nzogbe Insomnia, and the rants in the press conferences, the expletive-laden rants. Like, I saw all this and watched all this and thought, you know, and I'd seen it before. He was a character. And I remember when he first came to Nottingham Forest, we were relegation threat, and then he kept us up. And the final day, I think he'd said if he kept us up, he'd go out into the centre circle and down a pint. So he did that. So he was kind of so friendly with the fans. And then fast forward a few months, and he was openly calling them morons in the press. Like, our jaws were just hitting the floor thinking, what are you doing? And he's needless to say, he got the sack quite not long after that. So I think for someone I played for, I think it would be Joe Kinnear. But again, looking at the sort of link to Louis van Gaal and that his last game, that FA Cup final, you really have to look. You have to go quite far to go to look beyond Alan Pardew's dance on the touchline. I think, you know, for a memeable footage, and you know, survived down the years on Twitter. Anytime you see something and you see Pardew's dance coming out, and he's kind of dad dancing in that FA Cup final, I think I've not seen many more bizarre things going on in the touchline than that.
Some lovely memories there. That is it for now. Many thanks to Gregor and to you, Alison, as well. You may find yourself with more time on your hands in the coming week, so do remember you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. All you have to do is search The Times subscription for more information. And we will be back with you on Thursday for the very latest game podcast. Keep safe in the meantime.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.